75 and 9, the awesome Wendy's in their prime. The bowl is quick, the batsman fine. Remember? Do you remember? Nope, I can't remember. That was too long ago. Yeah. Holding Marshall, Garner, Lloyd, and Mighty Bib. Mighty Bib. They were going for the hat trick, the greatest team that lived. That lived. They swagger and they stagger out. They shake their heads, they cry. How on earth did we lose to a team that played Yash Pal at five?
Hello and welcome to yet another episode of Talking World Cup. The tournament's rattling along and we're doing our best to keep pace with it at ESPN Cricinfo. Without further ado, it's time to say hello to our panel for this episode. Jared Kimber, Cricinfo's global writer and host of the Cricket Series Star, joins us after quite some time. Hey Jared, where are you at the moment?
Back in London.
You're back in London. You're going to cover some games very soon?
No, I've actually got a couple of days off, so I'm just writing some features.
Great. We've got you on one of the 2 days. From far down the Southern Hemisphere, it's Dan Brettig, podcasting star in his own right in the Aussie rules football world. Hey, Dan, welcome.
Great to be here.
Lovely. And to join the two Aussies is our in-house Aussie fan, probably clad in his yellow 92 World Cup jersey, Gaurav Sundararaman. Hey, Gaurav.
Hi, that jersey was reserved for yesterday, although it didn't really go the way it had to, but good to be here.
As you might have made out, we're recording this the morning after India beat Australia for once in a World Cup. It's been a while and it happens very rarely. And we're talking all things Australia today. We'll start with Jared straight away. Jared, you had written in the tournament preview that the Aussies almost feel a national birthright to make it to the last four and hence you'd never rule them out, even though England are the favourites. Has that changed yet? After three games, are you sticking to it?
Well, I still think they're probably one of the stronger teams in it. But I mean, if yesterday was a perfect example of why they probably won't win it. Their batting is very shallow and their bowling is shallower. So, you know, you don't write off a team that has Mitchell Starc in it because I think we saw against the West Indies, he basically carried Australia to a victory there and he has the ability to do anything with the ball. But in reality, I think I've been to two of their games and watched the other one on TV and I haven't been that impressed with them so far. I think they've been pretty average and I think their weaknesses are there for everyone to see.
And yet, I think nobody, given their record in the past, nobody would want to face them in a knockout clash because if Australia make the last four, all bets should be off. Dan, what's been your take so far?
I think what we're seeing from the Australian team at the moment is that they spent a year trying to adapt their team to not having Smith and Warner, and also, I might add, to not having all of Starc, Hazelwood and Cummins available to them in white ball cricket and finding a way to play well and win with some or all of those names missing. And they did that. They did that particularly in India. The series subsequently against Pakistan, I don't think deserved as much merit based on how weak the Pakistan side turned out was. But yeah, they got there in terms of a formula without them. Then bringing these guys back into the team, that's a change of dynamic. And you also have decisions made, you know, difficult decisions made about who you were going to leave out. And guys like Peter Handscomb and Ashton Turner are missing. You also had Jai Richardson get injured. So yeah, they find themselves having seemingly hit on a formula that may work, having to change it again almost in the middle of the tournament.
Yeah, Gaurav, I'll come to you. Before that, Jared, the World Cup's got quite a long history now. It's not like it's a five-edition tournament or anything. If Australia happened to go all the way, which they're likely to do, as you said, nobody's writing them off after one loss, would you classify this as anywhere close to one of the weaker Australian sides to do well in a World Cup? Because they've started off quite well despite the one loss against India so far.
I don't know. That's quite a weird question to ask because one-day cricket is so different to what it was in 1987 when no one was really playing one-day cricket and no one understood it. So obviously that was the year you would say maybe one of the weakest, that was probably the weakest side that won it. And you could argue that the 99 side was, you know, a combination of very strong and very weak as well at times. But realistically, it's, you know, one-day cricket is so different. Like, you know, teams like England have been basically spending 4 years preparing for this. India probably 2 or 3 years preparing for this. The West Indies now, you know, their players are so highly trained in white ball skills from traveling around the world. So it's a very different world. What it looks like to me is that a lot of other teams like New Zealand, for instance, are incredibly well disciplined and well prepared for this tournament. And Australia has just picked the most talented players at the last minute and hoping that is going to work. Now, it may work, but if it does work, it doesn't say a lot for the talent pool of white ball cricketers around the world outside of Australia. But realistically, I can't see how they're going to win two knockout games in a row when it counts with the massive flaws that they have within this team. I mean, what Dan said before about this, you know, the Warner Smith coming back in and the fast bowlers coming back in. I think regardless of that, they are actually missing the key ingredients. They're missing a Hardik Pandya or a Moeen Ali or a Ben Stokes or, you know, Jason
Holder. Are they using the Hardik Pandya, the closest they have to Pandya, or the best they can? I'm talking about Maxwell. Some of us thought he could have come far higher ahead in the order yesterday, Jared.
Yeah, but regardless of that, I mean, realistically, the bigger problem was that the top order wasn't batting fast enough. It wasn't that where Maxwell came in that was ultimately the problem. Had he come in and they needed 8 or 9 and over at that stage rather than 10 or 11 and over, he could have batted within himself and probably could have got Australia to the win easy. But the problem is more that Hardik Pandya bowled his overs up front. He almost bowled, I think there was only one over he bowled later in the innings. He bowled most of his overs very early on to get him out the way. Marcus Stoinis was Australia's death bowler. I think Maxwell and Zampa might have bowled after the 40th over. That shows how badly put together that bowling attack is, that they've got basically putting together bowlers, and Coulton Iyer bowled out early like they were afraid for him to bowl at the end. That is a real, real concern for Australia. And, you know, other teams don't seem to have those sorts of problems.
Gaurav, this point about Australia chasing, which Dan absolutely rightly pointed out, in terms of Hanscom and Turner missing, they were two of their better chasers and guys who paced the innings in India, even when up against big totals. Is it just a question of, for example, yesterday Finch lost the toss and they were forced to do what they don't like doing, to chase 350 total? Is that going to be a weakness going forward? Because there are going to be high-scoring venues. Of course, the finals at Lords, which is not such a high-scoring venue, but going later into the tournament, the pitchers are going to dry down further and spinners are going to have a say a lot more. That's what's predicted.
Yeah, I was looking at some numbers from how Australia have gone about chasing, and yes, that 350 was an aberration, but they're usually not very good at chasing high scores. But one thing I think they're really good at is actually playing spin. I think they managed to play Kuldeep and Chahal way better than what most other teams would do. A lot of teams would look to attack and would have lost their wickets. They didn't get beaten all ends up, and they kind of read the spinners well. Yes, the target was slightly high. They couldn't score, get the boundaries, but at least they didn't lose their wickets early. So that's the positive thing. But yeah, in the history of the World Cup, they had not even conceded 300. So they've never actually been put in such a situation too often because of their bowling attack. And like both Dan and Jared have been saying, my concern is Cummins and Stark taking the new ball. So I just felt that both are extremely good bowlers, and Cummins taking the new ball, yes, look for early wickets, but what happens if it exposes the overs number 10 to 40, where they are forced to bring in Cummins and Stark back. In fact, the game against West Indies, if the batsman had survived those few deliveries of Stark and Cummins, there's a very, very good chance that West Indies would have actually won that game. So you can't just bank on these two taking wickets every single time. If they have bad days like yesterday, then it gets a bit scary. So which is why the backup pacers of Behrendorf and maybe Kane Richards and these guys come into the picture.
You'd have to argue yesterday that they looked like they had two frontline bowlers. They basically looked like they had Stark and Cummins. And if you look at the rest of the bowling, Coulton Iyer's bowling may or may not be right at the level that you need for one day. He seems a little bit down on pace to me, as much as anything. Freddie might be able to talk about that as well. But Zampa has lost his control in this tournament, which is, he's a leg spinner, and that does happen to him sometimes. And then you're putting together a fifth bowler out of Stoinis and Maxwell and hoping for the best. I just don't see how that kind of attack can win a World Cup, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, it was a warm-up game, but in a game which suited their formula, they've already beaten England, it must be remembered by all of us. Of course, those games aren't the same as a big World Cup game. Now, Dan, just coming back to you, there have been quite a few questions around selection, even when Australia were winning, even before the game against India, in terms of whether you'd like a guy like Nathan Lyon to offer control in the middle overs, because that seems to be lacking. As Jared pointed out, the Stoinis and Maxwell cobbling together 10 overs. Zampa isn't that much better with the bat as well. So is there sort of a case for playing another spinner in Lyon as the tournament goes on, especially with the pitches point that we mentioned earlier?
I think given the sorts of surfaces that we will see as the tournament goes on, and certainly what it was like at the Oval, I think Australia have to play Zampa and Lyon together. I don't think bringing Lyon in place of Zampa is necessarily going to plug the hole, in the sense that he will work better in isolation than Zampa will work in isolation. I think the two of them in the same attack work quite well together, provided that they both feel confident in their roles and secure in their places. And that was something that was starting to build up quite nicely over those series against India and Pakistan and the warm-up matches as well. And I think you mentioned the game against England, the way that Zampa and Lyon bowled together in Southampton in that game, I think that gave you a decent example of what's possible if they're bowling together. But the issue is that is not something that Australian white ball teams have done just about ever, having dual spin. And they clearly saw that it's something that they need to consider, and they may do it later in the tournament. But I do feel that some ground has been lost, in that they were doing that at length in the lead up to the tournament to try to see if it would work. It looked like it was working, but then they went back to the third quick and I guess disrupting that balance, which then in turn, you know, puts more pressure on the Cummins and the Starks of this world. And I think in terms of Cummins and Stark, if you've got a third quick in the team, perhaps some consideration to Cummins bowling more in the middle and being given that role rather than bowling at the front with the new ball, perhaps giving the second over with the new ball to the other quick bowler.
Jared, just coming to you back on the point about the later stages of the tournament, specifically I'm thinking of a side like New Zealand or England. Will that aura of Australia facing them in a tournament context carry them over the line as much as just the cricket itself?
Yeah, I'm not a big believer in aura. I think that the reason Australia has won so many World Cups is because Australia were better at one-day cricket than everyone else and had more talented players, maybe took it serious at an earlier stage than a lot of other countries did, due to the tri-series and things like that. So when people say, you know, Roger Federer has a great aura, well, Roger Federer also is just a better tennis player than everyone else. And this current team is not a better one-day team than a lot of other teams. And we've just talked about fixing the bowling, and I think Dan's right. I think they're probably going to have to go Zampa and Lyon, although Zampa does not look like he's bowling, certainly not like he was recently. So, you know, we're essentially in a situation here where it's not that weak. It's not that strong a team. So if New Zealand and England, for instance, are looking at this and being afraid of the great Australia, I think that would be nonsensical. I think they'll probably be afraid of, you know, an Aaron Finch 150 or, you know, Mitchell Stark Pfeiffer, and that's completely fair enough. But they shouldn't really be that worried about the entire team. And I worry that that's even a concern at this stage. The other point I just wanted to point out about playing the two spinners that Dan was talking about, I think part of the reason they're not doing it is because they think it weakens their batting. And I think Nathan Coulter and I are making runs against West Indies, which probably won them the game, might give them a selection headache going forward, because he's not going to be able to replicate that. He's not as good a batsman as Liam Plunkett, and Liam Plunkett doesn't make runs that often either. And it was one of the luckiest innings I've ever seen. And when he had to face real bowling, bowling really well the other day, he looked completely out of his depth. So if I was working for New Zealand right now and I saw any players being worried about like playing Australia in the final, I'd be like, you guys are mad. This is the team you want to play in the final.
Aura or otherwise, Australia have got a phenomenal record in World Cups over the years. And one of the things that we see as much as their success is the off-field talk and the pre-tournament predictions. This time, even the likes of Glenn McGrath have stayed away. He's said that England are the favourites to win the World Cup and so on. But we're starting to see signs of what might be off-field battle. Just before the West Indies game, I think it was Coulter Nile who said Stark will knock off Gale's off-pole, and Cummins even coming with a comic nickname, misrepresentation of Gale, calling him Mr. Worldwide or whatever. Are we starting to see signs of that, especially with the 10-game winning streak and Australia starting to do well? There's much more success, as Justin Langer keeps talking about.
I think they are conscious of having a balance between being a more humble, I suppose, team than they were in the past. Very much greater emphasis on their on-field behaviour and how they're treating people in general. But also that has to coexist with, and I think in some ways clash with, something that Langer and also Ricky Ponting, the assistant coach, bring very strongly to the team, which is we're Australians, we play World Cup cricket better than anyone else. This is how we do it. We don't copy what other teams are doing. We go our own way. And that kind of level of confidence, even hubris, is something that they think is key to Australian sides being successful, that they walk out onto the pitch feeling, well, essentially feeling like their opponents don't necessarily deserve to be in the same company as they are. So, you know, there is a bit of an ongoing tension there between, I suppose, trying to reinvent the image of the Australian cricket team in the wake of Newlands last year, but also that you've got right there as the coach and the assistant coach in Langer and Ponting, two guys who have been very heavily invested just in the concept of Australian pride, confidence, and projecting that in terms of how you look at opponents and how you deal with them.
Just to add to that as well, I thought from my perspective that it was basically the Australian bowlers don't believe Chris Gayle can play fast bowling anymore. And they think that when the ball's over about 130, 135 Ks, he's not the batsman he once was, which I think is pretty much backed up by the numbers. And in fact, a lot of the West Indian cricketers from memory are very similar when it comes to that. They once the bowling is very quick, their records do drop quite a bit. So I thought it was literally them trying to goad him into doing something stupid. Because realistically, I thought the best chance of the West Indies beating Australia was Chris Gayle just blocking out Stark and Cummins and then taking down everyone else. And I wonder if that wasn't a tactical thing as much as anything. We've got the wood on him. Let's fire him up even before the game starts. But I could be wrong.
They almost preempted and they got him out thrice in three balls or thrice in four balls that over Jared. Just on the point of Australians being the humble, nice guys post Newlands, post ball tampering, how true are they themselves to that image? Because it feels weird for some of us watching from outside. For example, yesterday when Kohli was asking the crowd to clap and Steve Smith coming and patting him on the back, it felt so un-Australian to watch that sort of thing happen, especially at a World Cup that too.
Yeah, I think we're still close enough to Newlands that they're probably still putting it there. But the real truth is what Dan just said about Langer and Ponting. They basically believe that Australians are superior to other people. And they believe that we play in a superior way. And we are, because of where we are born in the world and the way that we have gone about cricket, we have this authority and this special power. Unless that goes, Australians are always going to fall back to arrogance and aggressiveness and all those sorts of things because there's too many people who actually believe the nonsense. And it is nonsense. As I said before, Australia's the best team in the world because, over the history of cricket, because it's had some of the best cricketers in the world. If you keep, you know, from Spofforth to Bradman to, you know, Bill O'Reilly, if you keep producing players like that through Warne, McGrath, Ponting, Gilchrist, you're going to be better than everyone else. New Zealand would love it if they had, you know, seven Richard Hadleys rather than one Richard Hadley. So there's a reason why Australia is better than everyone else, and it's got almost nothing to do with, you know, this aggressive attitude. It's they play a slightly different form of cricket because the pitches are different, and they have had an incredible line of cricketers come through because club cricket is a brilliant way of making cricket. So realistically, I think you see with what Dan said that they will eventually revert to type. It may not be in this World Cup, of course, but while Langer and Ponting are around and Brad Haddin is in that change room, I don't really expect anything to change with Australian cricket.
Brad Haddin, of course, famously called out New Zealand for being too nice just before the final in the previous edition. Gaurav, what Jared said brings us nicely to a point which I was going to ask you in terms of, you know, it was obviously weird to see India beat them. It doesn't happen too often. Where do you see them changing or fixing stuff within the 15-man squad? And what do they need to do to kind of avoid days like yesterday? I'm sure the answer is as simple as bowl better, bat better, feel better. But I'm sure there's something tactical in that. The Maxwell question, which I posed to Jared, that could be one of the fixes that they do going forward, especially if they encounter a situation like this again. All it needed for them was to lose the toss and things not go their way on that.
I'm not sure why the tone of this whole podcast is so negative in terms of Australia. The fact is they've lost to India by 20-30 runs in spite of playing very poorly. And I think Warner, Smith, etc. are very... they're scoring runs. They've scored 250s each and both seem to be in good touch. It's just that they came across a very, very good Indian bowling lineup in Bumrah and Bhuvi. And I think the strategy was, I'm sure, was to take the match deep and try to score 100 of the last 10. And that's exactly what they did. They needed about 115 of the last 10. Just that Smith and Stoinis lost their wickets in that over. So I don't think there's too much of panic required. But what... a couple of positions seem to be very, very problematic, according to me, for Australia. One is Marcus Stoinis, because he really hasn't done anything of note over the last couple of years for him to grant a place in the squad. And
would you play a line over him?
So that's the tricky one. They don't have a replacement for Stoinis as such in the squad, and they don't have another all-rounder, which is where a guy like Ashton Turner could have been more useful. By picking Stoinis, now you have to play him because he's a batting all-rounder more, and he's supposed to perform at that position, and he's not. And they can't replace him with Lyon, because then the batting becomes too... it's not too deep, because Maxwell, you don't know what you're going to get from him. So I think that's where they made a mistake. They don't have a backup for Stoinis. So what will eventually happen is the only change I foresee is Nathan Coulter-Nile going out and maybe Jason Berendorf coming in. But what Dan said was a very valid point about playing Lyon and Zampa together. But I don't remember a team, especially a World Cup team, playing two spinners. And again, they're not like world-class spinners. They're spinners who Lyon gets good control, and Zampa has been on and off good. So maybe based on the opposition they play Pakistan next, they play Sri Lanka again. So I don't think they should tinker too much with the team. Maybe the only change I would maybe do is replace Nathan Coulter-Nile with Berendorf. But there was talk in the post-match about Aaron Finch saying that, Pakistan have a lot of left-handers and maybe we will look to play Nathan Lyon then. But again, when you actually go to that lineup, they do not have, apart from the openers, it's Hafiz, Babar, Shoaib Malik, Sarfaraz. So there aren't actually any major left-handers in the middle order. So I'm not sure what he was actually thinking there when he said that. So I wouldn't change anything. I think things are going well. Yes, if they bat first, it's a different ball game. But if they chase, they just have to figure out a strategy where they kind of make sure that the gap between the required on it and the actual on it is not too high. And again, every team does not have a Bumrah. So I think Australia are much well placed than what we seem to be discussing.
Massively disagree. Massively disagree. Because what you've just said, basically what you've just said is, you don't really rate Marcus Stoinis. And if he doesn't work, I don't see how Australia can win this World Cup, right? He basically needs to come off with the bat more often than not, which he may or may not. And then he's got a huge role with the ball. He's one of them. He's one of the five first picked bowlers in this team. And then on top of that, Zampa was bowling half trackers yesterday. I feel like you didn't even watch the game, Gaurav. Zampa has struggled to actually land the ball correctly in this series.
It was set Rohit Sharma, Jared. Yeah.
Yeah. And in the other game against the West Indies, he was pushing the ball out. He's not getting through his action. They have massive problems. And the fact that they didn't come in with a backup to Marcus Stoinis, that they didn't want Mitchell Marsh, kind of tells me that they put all their faith in this one position, and I just can't see how he's going to be consistent enough in that position with bat or ball at the moment. And I think we've seen him even in T20 cricket. He's actually become a much better player in T20 cricket when he's batted up the order, which he's not even allowed to do here. So I just think that they don't have the players that they need to actually win this World Cup. So this Berendorf for Nathan Coulter-Nile might work, because at least Pat Cummins then can be moved into those middle overs. But that's what, and it's the same again if Berendorf didn't play and Nathan Lyon came in. But the minute Berendorf or Nathan Lyon come in, that's the thing. The two changes that we've talked about doing both weakens the batting, and we don't think the batting's that strong. That's That's why we're being negative in this podcast. It's because all the fixes that we have still don't fix.
But Jared, just and Dan, for both of you, look, they haven't bought in a replacement for Stoinis. They could have, the only person I think they could have was Ashton Turner, but he didn't, he doesn't fit in the squad. He could have come in maybe for Kane Richards, and that's the only other slot possibly vacant. But having said that, yes, their middle order is very weak. I agree to that. But anything can happen in the semis and finals. The aim is to actually make the semis and then take it game after game from there, depending on who your opposition is. It's either going to be India or England mostly, if you assume that those two finish one and two. So having said that, they don't have a replacement. So this is what they need to do. So and the point about weakens the batting, I don't know if your top six cannot do anything, or even if your top seven can't do, I don't know how much Nathan Coulter-Nile can do, because Pat Cummins and Stark are not very bad with the bat anyway.
Gaurav is a bubbling fountain of optimism. Dan, you're saying...
I don't think they should be without optimism, but that, I think there's something that we haven't touched on yet, is that, you know, Khawaja going from three to four and Smith going up to three, when Smith is one of their best middle order, most adaptable middle order players. Like I said, one of only two they've actually got in the squad. Yeah, that was a crazy move, I thought.
Was that to split the left-hander and the right-hander against the...
Oh, yeah, no doubt that it was. But, you know, the issue is in terms of the type of player coming in to fit the role that you need at the point of the innings that they were at. It's not... that's got to go deeper than whether someone's a right-hander or a left-hander.
Yeah, so Jared, just closing thoughts before we go ahead. You're seeing more reasons for them to not be optimistic or panic than the rest of us. Is the fact that the strong form and the runs that Warner and Smith have made, do you think they're still, to a large extent, dependent on the two guys who've come back rather than the guys who've been doing well this year? For example, Akwaja, who's not really done well so far.
Yeah, I look at India and England, and more and more New Zealand, and I look at teams who have basically worked out how to consistently win in modern one-day cricket, right? And you look at Australia, and you're looking at a team who, at the World Cup, is trying to work out how to consistently win. I know they won a few games beforehand, but even then, that was only in the last few months. It's a different one-day game now than it was recently. And so when we say they've got a weak middle order, and then we say they don't particularly have a very strong lower order, if you're going to chase 350, you either need a incredible middle order, you need someone like Dhoni in it, for instance, or you need to be like England and bat very deep. Australia doesn't really do either of those things. And I think that's what I can't help but look at, you know, and go back to. And then the fact that they don't seem to have five frontline bowlers, and I'm not even sure they have four frontline bowlers in the current team. That none of that says that they can't win the tournament, because Mitchell Stark is so good. In Stark we believe. But realistically, they shouldn't win this tournament because there are better teams around. And there's nothing that we've said here. The changes that Dan and Gaurav have talked about, I think, are both valid changes. I'm not sure it makes the team that much better, though. And when it comes down to it, the reason they took the chance on Marcus Stoinis is they didn't have anyone better. You know, Ashton Turner is not that much, you know, he's maybe a slightly better batsman than Marcus Stoinis, but he's not as good a bowler. They just don't have the exact right 11 at the moment. But they have Mitchell Stark, so, you know, anything can happen.
You see, India, England, even to, like I said, New Zealand, the one thing that unites them so far is the number of guys who put their hands up in terms of performance. Nathan Coulter-Nile, of course, is one hero for Australia, but just the sheer number of guys. India, I think, had six or seven guys contributing to the win yesterday. Dan, if he had to do a post-mortem at the end of the tournament, and should things go the way Jared has envisioned, rather than Gaurav's optimistic progress to the last four and then be Australia after that, where would you put the finger on, where can we say Australia have not played the modern version of ODI cricket that we keep talking about? Is it in the last 4 years, or does it actually go beyond that, or the 4 years before that? Or where would you think Australia probably didn't have a great tournament, assuming we're doing this after the tournament?
Well, I think they missed an opportunity to be a bit braver and a bit more different to what they won with, say, for instance, in home conditions in 2015, and haven't really found something new and distinctive, different to that. The issues around Newlands and the bans for Smith and Warner put them in a position where they really had nothing to lose by trying something different. They had to, by definition. And they got to a point, as I say, certainly on the tour of India, where it looked like they were getting something together that could work. And it didn't necessarily have to include Ashton Turner. I think something that we should mention that we hadn't previously is that he also had shoulder issues, which made it, he was not necessarily going to be that great either as a bowler or in the field. So on some level, you can understand his omission. But, the emergence of Pete Hanscom as I say, a middle order specialist who was being able to play adaptably, shuffle a little bit in the batting order according to position, but could also make 100 as the backbone of a chase. That sort of adaptability, yeah, I feel as though they had an opportunity to have a lineup that was a little bit more 2019, but they have, and also obviously in terms of the use of twin spin, which is, you know, almost antithetical to what the Australian team has played one day cricket as. They had the opportunities to go in both those directions in this World Cup, and at the selection table, they essentially have chosen not to. So, if they don't win this World Cup via the, I suppose you'd say, the old Australian way, then, yeah, it'll look like a missed opportunity to me.
So, Dan, one important change has been that of Ricky Ponting and Justin Langer now in the coaching setup, and both are natural coaches in their own right, and Ponting's been pretty successful in his T20 franchises, as well as Langer's been extremely successful in the Australian setup. Now, who will be calling the shots? Will there be, what's their equation like? And when two big cricketers actually end up making decisions, you know, it could go either way. And Finch, what kind of a captain is he in terms of actually listening to them? One thing we've not yet actually discussed is Finch captaincy. I thought both the games he was pretty good in bringing his bowlers. Is it something which Ponting drives, team management drives, or is Finch a good captain in his own right?
Dan, I hope you're going to say Sridhar and Sriram's calling the shots.
Well, the thing with Finch is that he, again, in terms of the team before Smith and Warner came back into it and Stark and Cummins were back available, he had developed quite well in terms of how he was captaining the team. He also, in that period, that same period, captained the Melbourne Renegades to winning the Big Bash. And so his captaincy had been developing well, even though most of the headlines were about that he wasn't scoring enough runs. And that, I think, to some degree, took attention away from the fact that he was improving and working out quite nicely as a captain in the field. But the dynamic then changes because Ponting is not the assistant coach with the Australian team consistently. He's just there for the World Cup and will be around for a little bit of the Ashes once they get to that. And the assistant coaches around the Australian team have been changing a little bit. You know, for instance, like David Saker left the team at the start of the year. So in terms of who's calling the shots, like Langer and Ponting have a long relationship as teammates and as friends. Ponting obviously is the former captain, the player who was revered by all of his teammates. And so, you know, obviously Langer is going to listen very carefully and closely to his opinions, but Ponting doesn't have the day-to-day knowledge up close of these players that Langer does, because Langer's been with them for each of the past 12 months. So the power dynamic is probably that Ponting has the aura, if you like, Langer more of the day-to-day knowledge of the players they're dealing with.
Right. Jared might say there's no aura involved in sport, but it's absolutely incredible considering the last 2-3 years Australia have had, that we're even talking about them being contenders, talking about them going through to the knockouts. We've seen, just taking a random example of the West Indies games, to what Australia is all about. They were just down and out in that game, and they had a freak batting performance, and then Mitchell Stark turned up. So anything could happen. Jared, concluding thoughts in terms of your pre-tournament prediction, saying that England are hot favourites, but Australia could lift the trophy. I did ask you about this earlier, but if you were to see them go through and win the tournament, will it be on the back of Stark?
I mean, if Stark doesn't star in the two knockout games, I could not see how Australia could win. They're that dependent on him. I'm not sure. And that's the big difference between, you know, Australia and all the other major contenders out there, even the West Indies. If Gale fails, there's still so much incredible batting that can pick up, and obviously, you know, the bowling attack as well. I just can't see, if Stark fails, how Australia will win games. I mean, you talk about that aura. We look at one-off games, and me and Gaurav obviously look at the analytics of it. That particular innings by Nathan Coulter-Nile, you don't get flukier than that. I don't know what his control percentage was, but I'm sure it was -5. He should have gone out about 83 times. And then when he went in...
The 30s yesterday, Jared. 30s control percentage.
Yeah, exactly. And the reason he was in the 30s yesterday is because he had to face a better bowling attack. I think when you say that they haven't been very good for a few years and they're suddenly good, that's because they have an incredible, five or six players who are just as good as anyone. I mean, Mitchell Stark still looks like the best white ball bowler in the world. If him and Bumrah probably would go head to head. Bumrah might be slightly better at the moment, but realistically, you know, to have that and to have Warner come back after dominating the IPL, even if he hasn't made that many runs for Australia, the talent is there. But do they have the best 11? I don't think they even close have the best 11 in this lineup, in this thing. And we talk about Ashton Turner. You could have had a middle order of Maxwell, Stoinis, Mitchell Marsh, and Ashton Turner would have been maybe the only sort of, and then you just throw Stark and Cummins in at the other end, would have been maybe the only sort of thing Australia could have done to pick an incredible 11. And that would have been very, very risky, and there's injuries and all sorts of things involved in that. But essentially, when it comes down to it, I just don't think they have the a balanced enough team to win in the finals. But as Gaurav said, they're two knockout games, so weird things happen if they make the finals.
Absolutely. Lots of differing predictions on this episode. On the shoulders of Stark, can Finch lift the World Cup trophy? If it happens, be sure that we'll be back and we'll reconvene to speak about the Australia that have conquered the world again, literally out of nowhere. Until then, thanks, Dan. Thanks for joining us all the way. It's late in Sydney. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gaurav. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
And thanks to you, Jared, for coming on your off day.
Not a problem. Cheers, guys.
Cheers. And thanks to you, listener. Of course, you can listen to us on iTunes, do all the good things there. Leave us feedback, rate us so that more and more people can find the podcast. We've been doing well during the World Cup. We've clocked a frequent number of episodes. So keep listening wherever else you get your podcast from, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, Audio Boom, or wherever else. Until then, it's goodbye from all of us at ESPN Cricket Info. Cheers.